Okay, tonight is December 3rd?
4th.
Tonight is December 4th, and 2022, that I got right, and it's the second class that we've had this year. I call it the beginning of Chassidus, and we're going to talk about the beginning, starting with the Baal Shem Tov. Last week we spoke about just the decline of Poland, what was going on in Poland at the time. Chassidus was a revolution. It means like today we grew up with Chassidim. It's part and parcel of the Jewish, you know, Jewish world. You have the yeshiva world, you have the Chassidus world. So, and this is really where it all began. It all began with this one. What I just did? Okay, pressed the wrong button. We really began with just one person, and his name was the Baal Shem Tov. And he really started, it was a revolution. He started just, it was really it was new. It was just a new way of focusing religion. He did it. His purpose was, it was an answer to a problem. And the answer to the problem was, in which we mentioned last week, was the Jews in Poland, especially Eastern Poland, and was just going through so much. They went through so much, starting with the Chmielnytskyi's uprisings. They were overall very poor. They did not have the opportunity to be able to sit and learn Torah, but they were Erlich Yidden. They were, you know, nice, you know, beautiful Jews, but the Torah was not accessible to them, and they were searching for things. And some of the things that they found they were looking into was the Frank movement, Shabtai Tzvi. He was just a secret Sabbatean, a secret Shabtai Tzvi person, and he attracted a following. This Frank, Jacob Frank, ended up converting to Christianity. I mean, just to show the end of it. As a matter of fact, the Baal Shem, he took that very hard when the Jacob Frank and his following converted. Is pretty much where we ended off. Like last week, it was just to him. He said, as long as if you have a diseased limb, so the limb could be saved as long as it's part of the body. But once you cut off the limb, that's it. You can't save it. Once they chose Christianity, it was unsavable. Again, this is a picture of in 1648. This is what Poland looked like. If you could tell. From Poland, it was like a tremendous area. It was the Poland-Lithuania Empire or country was tremendously big. This is on the eve of the Chmielnytskyi's uprising. Eventually, it's going to be from this point on for the next. This is what we did last week. For the next 150 years, it's going to be slowly but surely chopped away and. By 1795, this is not going to be a Poland on the map. It's why do we have Poland today? Because after World War I, when the Allied powers decided to redraw the map, they recreated the country of Poland. Poland, it was divided up into many sections. Lithuania was the north section. As a matter of fact, Lithuania always maintained some sort of independence from Poland. So it was Lithuania and Poland. And we mentioned that at some point they made they joined the empire together. The king of both, but Lithuania had its own constitution, if you will, as opposed to Poland. This would be called Greater Poland, Lesser Poland, Galicia. Now, our story is going to take place in Podolia. You see the south southern eastern part of Poland. The one who came after, the leader of the Hasidic movement that came after the Baal Shem, was the Maggid of Meserich, and he is going to move up into Volhynia, if I'm saying it correctly, Volhynia. And that this is basically where Hasidism starts. Mm. It's going to eventually sweep, and it's eventually sweep the boards. They're going to take over. They're going to be a majority at some point in Europe, especially in Poland, really. But they're going to take over a majority of Poland. Okay, so let's just last year we ended off. We did more about the life of the Baal Shem Tov. So I thought just we would just go through, instead of going through how he grew up and he was a malamed and he was orphaned and he, you know, attached himself to these these holy people, and how he got married and he went into the Carpathian Mountains, and there he came in contact with Achia Shiloni. But that this was his own personal biography. We mainly spoke last year, but I thought I would just what's important for him as the leader of the Hasidic movement. So he was born in 1698. It's easy, 1700, just 2 years before that. That's when the Baal Shem was born, and in 1724 he came in contact with the spiritual world. He came in contact and he had a mentor, Achia Shiloni. We spoke about many people that had contacts with people that were spiritual people. Ruchnius, we mentioned the Mesillas Yesharim, the Rav Chaim Lozato, right? That's
Ramchal.
He and others. It was not very common, but people did have these the Arizal. He was also somebody. We had people that had contact with them. Who at least claimed that had contact, and maybe they did, was also Shabsai Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza. They also had some sort of contact, and they could have gotten it from the Ruach HaTumah as opposed to the Ruach Kedusha. And there was a tremendous backlash against all the Kabbalah and against any type of spiritual connection like this. And Reb Chaim, the Ramchal, Reb Moshe Chaim Lozato, he paid for it. He was very hounded because he came just while they were, you know, trying to root out these secret Sabbateans, right? This is what we spoke about this. Mm-hmm. But in any case, the Baal Shem in 1724, the Achia Shiloni. Who was Achia Shiloni? Achia Shiloni was the Rebbe of Elio Anavi. You know, so the Rebbe, Elio's Rebbe, Achia Shiloni. He is part of the Mesorah. When you go for the Mesorah Torah, you know that Moshe Kibul Torah Misina Yeshua, Mesorah Yeshua, Kane and Nevi'im. You know, and through the in the Nevi'im is Achia Shiloni. So the Mesorah of Torah goes through Achia Shiloni. Okay, and he was the one that had a connection, the Baal Shem Tov had a connection with him, and it says that he was teaching him the Torah, the secrets of the Torah, from beginning to the end. It took about 10 years. And after 10 years, Achia Shiloni was insisting, for many years, insisting that the Baal Shem Tov go public. Go teach the world and make, you know, and like do what he can to save the Jewish people. Okay, Rav Adam was a very holy man in those days in the 1700s. You also had these very, very holy, pious men. And they had also their get-togethers, and they were also very, but, you know, they were like to themselves. They weren't, you know, they did not necessarily, some of them did, you know, get up in front of the public and try to convince other people to do better. Most of the time they had their chevra would get together and make, you know, and serve Hashem the way they would, whether it's they would stay away from physical, and they would just be very holy people. So he was, Baal Shem, he had a relationship with this Rav Adam, and Rav Adam convinced him that he should be a teacher, he should go out to teach other people, as well as Achia Shiloni. Sorry?
Did they, these men, and especially the Baal Shem Tov, did he stay like private, didn't want to go out public because of the disappointments of the Sabbatean movement and all these...
I don't know. I don't know if one had to do with the other, but Generally that's what they were. You had these holy men, and that's what they did, you know? I'm sure in our community you have these people. Yeah, I can think of a few people that they're very, very, you know, just what they do is they sit and they learn, they have their own corner, and they, you know, and people talk to them, and they're just really unbelievable, great people.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not the ones getting up in front and teaching the congregation. You know, they're influencing in their own way, in their, you know, how they influence. But it seems that they wanted that the Baal Shem should go out and teach people, go public and have a direct influence on other people. Okay, some of the things that the Baal Shem Tov said, again, it was revolutionary and it was not at all accepted. The way things were, or the way things were for over 1,000 years, nothing really changed. And now the Baal Shem, again, what was he dealing with? He was dealing with these people that were down and out, they had no physical, they were very poor, and they didn't have Torah. And what he did is he was trying to appeal to these people by saying, you have value, you have worth. In other words, when you make a bracha, you know, your bracha means as much to Hashem as this person sitting in the base of Medrash learning 10 hours a day. And your simple brachas that you're making in earnest, Hashem loves that just as much. Now, you could imagine why this would not go over well for the people in the yeshivas, right? You could just imagine, like, you know, his bracha, I mean, we're sitting and learning, we're doing. And that's really what Torah learning, you know, that's what, the way it was, you know, all through the generations. Torah is, that's it, everything you all learn. Who is the greatest in the generation is the person who is the greatest Torah scholar. And he was the one to look up to, and he was the biggest, you know, and the more Torah you learn, the more you were looked up to. And now you're coming along and saying that this person who's unlettered, you know, maybe could read, maybe can't read, but his bracha is the same as this person learning. So you could understand why it would not go well over in the scholarly world. And again, when we had over here in Podolia and Volhynia, this area was really taken over by the Cossacks. They really conquered much of the eastern side. The yeshivas are in Lithuania, in the north, and over here, where the Cossacks, Khmelnytsky, didn't reach. So there was less disturbance of the yeshivas, and in Vilna, in that area, in Lithuania, the yeshivas were able to continue. So you have up here where Torah is much more spread out and more people are learning, as opposed to down here, where it has gone through a lot. And Podolia, we mentioned, for 25 years was really under the Ottomans. And the Ottomans was still influenced by Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was always in the Ottoman Empire. The secret Sabbateans were always in Ottoman. But when Podolia was under the Ottomans, so now you had that influence. And so you had all these influences. and lack of learning, and comes along now the Baal Shem, and he says, "Hey, let's make brachas. Your bracha, it means a lot to Hashem."
Now, the people would be distressful because of what they went through with Shabbosai Shvi.
You know, they were
like the same type of
correct
message.
You're right, but they were looking for something, and here you had something which was within the circle, within the framework, within the what's accepted of Judaism. The followers of Shabbosai Shvi was a very Kabbalistic thing, and they also very immoral. You know, they had we mentioned it the last time, they were using the Arizal's Kabbalah of getting, you know, there were these sparks, nitzotzos, that were all over the world, and when the Jews are in exile in different places and they do mitzvahs, they grab these sparks. These sparks are covered by klipos and tumah forces, and when you do mitzvahs, you get them. It's just such a warped thing, these Shabbosai Shvi people, is, you know, sometimes you have to do the worst acts to get to those, you know, immoral acts, adulterous acts to get to those sparks. I don't know, maybe if you say it fast enough, people, you know, won't get you on it. But there were people that were following it. And it could be these are good people that didn't know any better, and they hear, you know, one thing. But now comes along the best, and now he's within the framework of Yiddishkeit, you can do this. And it was within the framework, it's just that he put a stress on different things. Everybody agrees you should make brachas, right? Just is your brachas what, if you're putting a point value, what do you put brachas is what, how much, is it a 3 or a 4, and learning Torah is a 10, you know, maybe, you know, and now you're putting Torah up as a, you're putting Torah and brachas both at a 7, you know, I don't know, you know, but that's what he did. This second thing is his purity of intent. You know, your kavana to do something is a lot more than what you're able to do. You know, if you actually do it, okay, you did it, you didn't, but machshava kamaisa, you put your intent, you want to serve Hashem, and that's very meaningful, that's very important, and that adds to what you're doing is right. Joy, humility, also something that was so important and revolutionized. When we talk about a chassid in Jewish literature, I mean, we're talking from the Gemara all the way on down. What was a chassid? A chassid was generally somebody who stayed away from the physical world. He was doing the not just the law, but the spirit of the law, you know, above what, over and above what the law would demand. So if the Torah permits a person to eat and drink and eat what he likes, but a chassid would be one as I don't, you know, there's a tension between a physical world and a spiritual world, and the more physical a person gets, the less spiritual he is. So a chassid would limit as much physical as he can to raise his spiritual, and that was the understanding of a chassid before the Baal Shem. Baal Shem himself said, "No, you don't. You got it all wrong. Or this is not what we want you to do. Is you have to serve Hashem with a joy. If you're not joyful by serving Hashem, it's not the same." You have to give to us Hashem the simcha. It has to be with joy, and that would raise your serving of Hashem. Well, when a person fasts and he's constantly punishing himself for past sins, he cannot be in joy. And he just can't be in joy, and you're going to be lacking in your service Hashem. So, what does Hashem want from you? Hashem wants you to eat and drink. And take care of yourself, and use that to serve Hashem, right? That's the Maaseh Yesharim brings that down as a difference between Kedusha and Tahara. Kedusha is even a higher level. Tahara is just staying away from the physical world. Kedusha is taking the physical world and making it spiritual. Mm-hmm. A classic would be Shabbos and Yontif. Mm-hmm. You know, what do we do Shabbos and Yontif? We eat, we drink, we have good food, we go to, was by four kiddushes today. You know? that's before my meal, right? Then I had my meal. That's, you know. So like that's what Shabbos is. You take the physical world around you and you just raise it. You elevate it by making brachos, by having that intent, by making yourself happy. When you're happy, that's the way to serve Hashem. These are ideas of the Baal Shem, and some of them
It seems like if you look at the Rambam was against, like, you know, not taking care of your fasting to the extent that you harm yourself and so on.
The Rambam may fall in the side towards the...
And he was far from...
Could be the Rambam... Right, so I don't know how you would, I guess maybe both sides would use the Rambam for themselves. They would say, well, that's for the masses.
Chabad use Rambam a lot, right?
Right.
But I'm just saying...
Right, your Rambam does say...
My parents came from Yemen, on the grandparents' side, you know, the Yemenites went by the Rambam also, and that's like totally different.
Right. So the Rambam is one of the basis of our halacha, but... It's very possible that people would say, well, the Rambam is talking for the Hamonam, for the normal people, for regular people, but we want to be above. Mm-hmm. We want to be above this person. So that was maybe the Rambam is for everybody else. Maybe the Hasidim would say, no, the Rambam is talking about everybody, you included. That's not the way, that's not what Hashem wants from you. But again, when you're talking about in the old times, the Hasidim, it was only individuals. We never had most of the Jewish people acting in that way, living a very ascetic life, and just staying away from. You always had your individuals, but they were really, really in the minority. All right, but that's who was called Hasidim. That was who was the Chassid before the Chassid today. Today a Chassid. When we say a Chassid, you mean a Chassidish guy, somebody who's. Who's a chassid of the Baal Shem. In 1733 is when he went public, we mentioned, and in 1740 he moves to a place called Mezibish, if I'm saying. I know I don't say words very well. And that's where he moved to, and that became his center of the movement. Now, I don't think the Baal Shem ever... considered it, yeah, we're starting a movement, you know. His point was to influence people, and he really worked on his main focus was getting gedolim, real talmidei chachamim, scholars, tzaddikim, and teaching them, don't be that ascetic person that's all by themselves, but you should, you know, what you should be is serving Hashem with joy and going out and influencing other people to be like this, to teach them, you know, how everybody together we can serve Hashem. And it's not just the few, you know, the proud, whatever. not just the few, but it's really for the masses, right? But his stress mostly, the Baal Shem was on gathering for himself great people around him. Here's just a small list here would be Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Polonaya and Pinchas of Karvitz. I'm going to have a different list after this. Rav Dov Ben Mezrich. Rav Dov Ben Mezrich is the Maggid of Mezrich. He's the one that's going to take over everything afterwards. Here's a list, another list of some of his greatest students. It doesn't mean that he didn't have common Jews that were around him that were influenced, that came and heard him, and you know, so that also happened, of course. But again, his stress was to take great leaders and make them, I guess, greater, or make them change their mindset, that they can go out and they can relate to people and make a movement, right? So again, he wasn't. I don't think he had in mind movement. He had in mind helping and changing and uplifting Klal Yisrael. Yeah.
Did he do any public speaking?
All the time. I'm sure he did. I'm sure he went all over. I guess that's You know, I don't know if he, you know, like he would go to be a scholar in residence and come into his town, and, you know, like we have today. But he did go around. He was also, we're gonna see, he was a healer. He knew medicine, so people would come to him both physical and for a spiritual. Here it is. He knew medicine, and people would come to him. He'd have herbs, and he'd have different ways of people having ailments. And so he was, not only did he heal people physically, but he was also trying to heal people in a ruchnius, spiritually as well. Okay, and this was what he did. We're going to see also he had a whole system with what the relationship between the tzaddik and the people are. I know we've spoken about that before, but we'll see. This is really what the connection from last week. He's the right person in the right place at the right time. Gedolia, we went through with, whether it's the Khmelnytsky massacres, the Ottomans, the Turks, the Muslims took over the area for about 25 years. Influence of Shabtai Tzvi, Jacob, Frank, he went public, you know, before Jacob Frank, he had this secret society of Sabbatean. So you could have a guy sitting next to you in shul, and he looks like, you know, he's davening well, and yet he was part of this secret membership, believing that Shabtai Tzvi was still his Mashiach, and do whatever they're doing, but privately. Jacob Frank came and made it a public thing, and then before he converted. Okay, this is sort of like, again, the same map as before. I just like label things again. Poland, Galicia, Podolia. This is where it all happened. There's Ukraine, like Russia, Lithuania. Over here, you circle, that's Mezobuz. That's where the Baal Shem made his place. Now, as you can see, many, many Jewish little towns and Shtetlach, I guess, where the Jews were, they all lived. And this is where he operated, and this is where his influence was for the 20-some-odd years, 25, 27 years that he was teaching again. You know, there's so many legends that he was in Mezobuz, and he said to his students, come, let's go, we have to go somewhere. And he gets on his horse and wagon, and they go to a certain place, and he'll go out, and he'll talk to somebody and come back, or... You know, just these are the legends about about the Baal Shem. Also, so when Poland took it back from the Muslims, so the Polish nobles were very interested in resettling it. So what happened at that point? Many new people came, and new Jews came, and it was like a new place, things were in movement and things were new. So once things are new, they're open to new ideas also. You don't have, you know, in the same place, you know, everybody's doing the same custom. This is what we've been doing for the past 50 years. You're going to come in now and you're going to tell me, you know, let's do things differently. In Podolia, there was such a change and a turnover that everybody who was there was like everybody starting new. So if you're starting new, start with the Baal Shem. He has a few good ideas. Why don't we do this as opposed to, you know, do that? And this is where Hasidism was able to take effect.
The rest of the Polish non-Jewish community, were they hostile? So?
Yeah. Hostile. But overall, in there were after the Khmelnytsky's uprising, there were also sporadic uprisings every so often. I don't know, every 10, 15, 20 years, something, again, there would be another uprising. But overall, in Poland, you know, they kept the lid on. You know, everything was, you know, in terms of active, you know, attacks and, you know, expulsions and everything, that overall didn't happen. You know, every so often there was another uprising that was put down. Nothing in the scope of Tachvatat of Khmelnytsky, but overall the Jews were there. Was there anti-Semitism? Absolutely. You know, but you know, the nobles were, you know, favorable to the Jews, but the peasants were not, and that's the way it was. And you know, the world wars, and this is
how
you know,
it was, that's how
just,
it is.
The true colors came out in World War II. It's just that uprising was just like a, you know, just a foreshadowing of what would happen later. Okay, so but Hasidism started from within. We all have the same, you know, understanding, the same Torah, the same mitzvahs, the same structures, but they added and they took what was and they would change a bit. That's what, you know, halacha was still halacha, but they put the stresses on different things. This we pretty much said, the same idea. Not only did he, you know, were these gedolim, he tried to get a circle of gedolim, but admirers, the hamonam, the regular people would come to him as well. Okay, they also did a few changes. Like, what were some of the changes that they did? They adopted Nusach Ari. Okay, that was one of the big changes. Instead of, not Nusach Ari, but they had a Nusach Sfarad. Today, we have three Nuschas, right? You have Nusach Ashkenaz, which is what this shul davens. Ashkenaz was Western Europe. Ashkenaz was Europe. You had Mizrach or Sephardi, which was from Spain. That was, you know, that was the Jews mainly, you know, came from Spain, that went to the Mediterranean basin. That they daven Sephard. You also had, and this is what my understanding is. I could be wrong about what I'm saying, but Nusach Ari was they took Sfarad, that, and he made like Kabbalistic changes, added to it. You know, so they, you know, it's mainly the same, but just things that they, to get Kabbalistic, Kabbalah ideas and thoughts into it, that's what Ari did to the Nusach that they davened in Spain. And Nusach Sfarad did the same, what Ari did to Sfarad, Nusach Sfarad did to Ashkenaz. And they added, like, you know, you take a look, you could daven in a Nusach Sfarad shul, just there's a few different, the words are a little different here and there,
it's basically
the same.
Of course, you daven slower because it's more words.
With more words,
yeah.
Right. It's also there are a few things that are out of order, you know, but basically is you could daven from one to the other, but the change was to be more, like, reflect more of a Kabbalistic in the davening.
But many yeshivas adopt that on the Sfarad.
Usually yeshivas are Ashkenazic. It could be some are Sfarad, but the general is Ashkenaz and yeshivas, and generally the Hasidim are Nusach Sfarad, not to be confused from Sfarad. I think today they call Sfarad.
Edot Hamizrach.
Right, Edot Hamizrach, East in the Mizrach. It's a different. That's. You could also daven in their shuls. I have davened. You know, I went to a camp, a Sephardi camp, but it's a lot. It's a lot different. It's more differences than Ashkenaz. And we probably do a whole thing on davening, but it's. I mean, it keeps the same structure. There's Pesukei Dezimra, and then Birchas Kriyashma and Shema and Shmona Esrei. Just there's differences in terms of the nusach and various things. Second is that they held the mikvah was more central, very, very important. Going to the mikvah, I guess, is all customs. You know, they used to have to go to the mikvah when there was real, when we needed to become tahar. And that's back in the day when we had a Beis HaMikdash, and back in the day when there was ashes for a paraduma, and when we had real trumas and maestros. So certain Jews had to be on a certain level of tahara, and a mikveh was essential. So since that time, we don't have real trumas and maisas. We don't really have opportunities or needs for going to the mikveh, and holy people would go to the mikveh as a custom. It would help in their in a certain level, it would help. But with the Hasidim, they made it more central. They felt that a person, again, to become that type of a person, to serve Hashem with intent, and that they going to the mikveh became more central. Okay, and the third over here is interesting. When I saw the slide, the polished knives for ritual slaughter. At some point, especially in the beginning, it was a machlokas between the Hasidim and the non-Hasidim, which knives to use. There was a certain type of knife that would that everybody was using, but it couldn't get as sharp. I don't remember exactly what the machlokas is, but the Hasidim felt that it was better to use a different type of metal or a different way of making it. It makes it sharper.
Yeah.
It may have been a different issue. I'm not sure if there was problems of nicks. Eventually, I think the Hasidim went out on this. Their process or their knives became the standard. But they came in with a new way of shechting animals, as opposed to the way that was done for hundreds, thousands of years. Okay. Where did they come from? They came. Who followed the Besht? Everybody. You had community rabbis and Torah scholars. You had preachers on Magidim, people that would go for. There was a class of people, class of rabbanim that would go from town to town, and they would speak to the people and they would try to inspire them. They were called Magidim. Especially in those days, you didn't have what for. That was the entertainment. You know, a good speaker would come, and that's, to a small town. There was no TV, internet, no. That's it. What'd you have? You had a speaker would come. So that was the preachers. You had shochtim, cantors, melamdim. Okay. Okay, this is also, again, we spoke more about this too. Okay, then came, now we're up to what happened. He passes away, or the Besht passes away in 1760. So 1761, he passed away on Shavuos. So the following year, his Talmidim, his students, they all got together. They all came to Mezhebish, and they all got together, and they had a nice, get-together. His son, Zvi Hirsch, had taken over the movement that year. So now, the second day of Shavuos the following year, they're all there, and he gets up and he says, "My father, the Besht, the Baal Shem Tov, came to me in a dream, and he told me that the next leader should be the Maggid of Meserich." And he gets up and he takes off his white kapata, his white hat, whatever it is, and he puts it around Maggid of Meserich. And from that point on, the Dov there from Meserich, he became the new leader of the movement. And it's under the Maggid of Meserich that Hasidim exploded all over. It went everywhere. He was a tremendous organizer, especially a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a tremendous influencer, tzaddik, and he was a tremendous organizer. And it was under him, he would send people to different places, and that's the going to be the next level, the next of Hasidus, the next stage of Hasidus. Okay, before I get to the Maggid of Meserich, I want to talk about maybe another one of his Talmidim. And this is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonia. Now, if I'm saying Polonia correct, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, what he was like there, the philosopher. He was a, also a very close Talmud of the Besht, but what was unique about him is he came up with a sefer. He wrote two or three svarim, and one of his sefer that made it was called Toldos Yaakov Yosef. I think he wrote another one, Satnas Paneya, Keser Shemto, different svarim. But this sefer went for the parsha, and he gave over, it was written, the philosophy of the Baal Shem, stories about the Baal Shem, philosophies about the Baal Shem, and that's what he did. Who was he? He was a, before he met the Baal Shem, he was a big Talmud Chacham in his own right. He was familiar in the Arizal's Kabbalah. He was a rabbi of Shargrad, and I guess he became controversial to such a point as one Friday they just threw him out of town. And later he went to Nemirov, and eventually he went to Polonia. These are the different cities. This is Mezhevish. This is where the Baal Shem was, and these are the two cities. And Polonia, I think, is up here. This is Polonia. I guess I forgot to put it in the box. So you see, this is all in the same area.
This is considered Galicia or no?
No, this would be considered Polonia.
Polonia.
Galicia, I guess, yeah. Podolia. Podolia.
But right. And Galicia, see, that was like traditional Ashkenazic yeshivas?
Yeah, Galicia. He's a Galicia. I don't know. I guess that was an area in Poland. It was another area in Poland. Lithuania, most of the yeshivas are going to be up here in Lithuania.
Mm-hmm.
This is
mm-hmm.
where Chabad is going to mm-hmm. go into White Russia. And eventually what's going to happen is as the movement spreads to the yeshivas, they're going to take notice of it. They're going to hear things that they're saying, and they're going to put them in Cheir, which we'll talk about later. Especially this sefer that I'm just mentioning, this was a biggie. They put this sefer in Cheir because of the things that he said. I'll have just a few things here that he said. It was in 1780 it was published. Again, the Baal Shem passed away in 1760. In 1780 it was the first sefer that brought down a lot of the Baal Shem. 249 times he said, I heard in the sefer, I heard from my teacher, I heard from my Rebbe, the Baal Shem. Okay, one of the things he talks about is the tzaddik. And he talks about how a tzaddik can be a great tzaddik. And now, his philosophy about the relationship between a tzaddik and the people is not the typical understanding about the way we, even us here now, understand the tzaddik and the individual. We have the Talmud Chacham, the Rosh Yeshiva, the greatest rabbi. So that's it. He is the head of the community, and he gets up and he teaches us, and we learn from him. But their understanding is that no. It even goes deeper than that. That your success, your even success in Ruchnius, and maybe even your Gashmius, all comes through the tzaddik.
He's not alive.
The one that is alive.
Oh, is alive.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I'll just give another one of his sefer, Keser Shem Tov. Okay, when he writes his sefer, he does quote Mendel of Bar, Nachman of Kosov, Nachman of Haradenka, Yudah Aryeh Leib of Piston, I'm not familiar with him, Menachem Mendel of Premishlov. So these people, and if he heard something from them, he quotes them. So this was like the main source of what the Baal Shem had. Parshas Re'eh. So in one of these sections, he talks about like this. He talks about, you get an idea, the sense of what was happening before the Baal Shem. A Magid would come to a community, right? And he'd say, well, there are three types of people, or three reactions to the Magid. You have one where, why did they come to the Magid? A sense of shame, everybody's going to be there. If I'm not seen there, where were you? The Magid came, so they come, but they're not really interested in the message. The second one is, he hears, he says, wow, that's a great idea. I think I would like to change. But that's it. As soon as he leaves the door, he forgets about it. That's like a second group. And the third group is those that don't even come at all. So here you have, you know, that the Magids, you know, they were trying to influence the people. And he goes through other explanations why they weren't successful. People didn't trust them. Who are you to tell me what to do? How do I know that you don't have the same problems? You know, but there was no, like, connection from these Magidim to the people that they were teaching. What one of the things that the Besht did, or Yaakov Yosef explains it, he says, you better get yourself a tzaddik, because all of your success comes through the tzaddik. And if you don't have a tzaddik, that's it. You're not going to be successful. Physically, in ruchnius, in money, everything, that's it. You are connected. And when he's there, when he's, you know, when you listen to him, and then you're influenced by him, you get raised up and he gets raised up. And if you don't, you're demoted, and so is the tzaddik. And that's like, another thing he says here, and this is where he's talking about the, you know, unfortunately, he's talking about
It sounds like what he was trying to do was add a fourth group, which is, instead of having this disconnect between the speaker and the people, he was trying to say, you need to find someone who you're going to have that connection to.
Correct.
So that you're not going to just
ignore them. And he gets this from
the
Besh. This is all the philosophy that he learns from the Besh. Absolutely. That's what he's trying to do, make that connection. You better find yourself a tzaddik. You just don't wait for a Magid to come. If you want that Magid, he's your tzaddik, that's fine. But you have to find somebody. And that really was an unbelievable change. Now that everybody needed a Rebbe, that and your success, everything that you do, because of course he's a tzaddik. The tzaddik Hashem gives special things to the tzaddikim, and through him you'll get yours from your tzaddik. Just, you know, this did not go over well in the yeshiva world. What have you said that my thing comes through a tzaddik? Everybody has their own connection to Hashem. Mm-hmm. Right? It doesn't go through a tzaddik. But again, his philosophy was you need these people to connect to a tzaddik. You know, and this is. He also said very interesting. He said there are three types of machlokism, really, against tzaddikim. One is the Jews among the nations, the Goyim. They put down Jews. Okay, that's one. The second is when ignorant Amaratzim, they denigrated Talmud Chacham. But he says the third, which is the worst, is when some Talmud Chachamim speak bad against other Talmud Chachamim. I think he was hinting here about the yeshiva world talking bad about the Hasidim. I don't know if he said it outright there, but this is, I think, what he was really alluding to.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when the Hamonam, they see big rabbis fighting against big rabbis, so that's it. If he's fighting it, I could also speak against him. You know, like, who are you? He says you're not good. I'm following him against you. And it causes a tremendous lowering of Torah, the esteem of Torah, and Chilul Hashem it brings as well. Another thing, let's see, this is in Shemini. Now this is where, again, he's talking about the tzaddik. He says, just like there are 365 los ases, and there are 248 positive commandments, 365 negative commandments, the body has 248 limbs, and 365 arteries. And what really happens is just like, you know, there's a ruchnius and a spiritual, if a person is lacking in his certain mitzvos, losases and ases is going to have an effect on the body. Right? This, I think, was before the Baal Shem. But he says the same way, that's the same relationship between a tzaddik and the people. That's what he wanted. That was his thing. Every tzaddik is a single limb of a spiritual body, gives life to and impacts a corresponding physical limb. So therefore, you know, you have your 248 tzaddikim or 365 tzaddikim, or maybe less or maybe more, and each of these tzaddikim have an influence on the hamonam, have an influence on non-tzaddikim. And that's why you better make your way, find yourself a tzaddik. He also then says, the worst thing you could do, he brings this Gemara on Shabbos, there is no cure for the wounds of one who denigrates a Torah scholar. If somebody denigrates and puts down a Torah scholar, the Gemara on Shabbos says, nothing you can do. That's it. There's no help for such a person. Why? So he explains, according to what we're saying, it makes a lot of sense. Because that scholar, that tzaddik, is your lifeblood. You're getting everything from him. And if you degrade him, and now nobody's going to follow him, or your life source is through him, you're degrading him, you're not going to get your life source. That's it. There's nothing to do. It's all done. What else did he say? Same idea that the heart is the tzaddik, and the rest of the body is the people. And if the people are slumbering and they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, they actually bring down the tzaddik. And that's what he always said. If when the tzaddik can bring the people up, that means, you know, if he's doing his job, he brings the people up with him. He says also, there's a tension always with tzaddikim. Tzaddikim, again, another piece, tzaddikim, in order to go to the people, they have to lower themselves to the people. But they have to somehow keep connected above. So when they're done dealing with the people, they could draw themselves higher. That's sort of the relationship is what the tzaddik has to go through to meet his people. Okay, these are different things of this is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, different things he said. He also quotes converting prayer into a great joyous experience, a loud voice, clapping hands, conveying the sound of joy. This was revolutionary in davening. Davening before the Hasidim came about was a quiet affair. People would daven like this. Hasidim came about and they're clapping and they're jumping in there. And it was just, again, a revolution in terms of davening. Why do you want that? You want to bring joy when you daven. You want to bring intention and kavana. And it was davening became an experience, not just, you know, a private thing form. Okay, Nachman Haradenka, he was another one of his students, but after the Baal Shem Tov died, he moved to Eretz Yisrael. He lived in Sfat and in Tveria, and I think after a year of living in Eretz Yisrael, he passed away in 1765. Okay. And I think next week we're going to pick it up with the Maggid of Mezerich. Okay? The Maggid of Mezerich is the next stage, and he's going to come about and he's going to also get himself a close-knit group of tzaddikim. And these tzaddikim, we've heard of many of them. Whether Neir Zalman of Leidy, the leader of the Balatanya of Chabad, Rav Eli Melech Melzinsk, the Shpola Rebbe, the Shpola Zaidi, a number of others as well. And what we hope to do is. What did he do, the Maggid of Mezerich, and how he was successful, and then who was his Talmidim, and what did they do, and how did they spread Hasidism? I think that's where we're gonna pick it up next week with the Maggid of Mezerich. Okay, any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.